You are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. Hello once again, I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. And if we are against so much, what do we stand for? Well, the ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society would look like while recognizing that none of us today are actually free. As ever, WXRW River West Radio needs your help. Times are tough for nonprofits, and especially so for nonprofits like us who seek to engage, educate, and activate the at-risk and the disenfranchised. If you would like to help us out, you can donate today as ever online. You can join our Patreon campaign. You can visit us in person at the station here at 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and purchase some gear, hat, shirt, a mug, wear and use that. If you represent a local business of any kind or an institution, please reach out and become an official underwriter. Form a relationship with us. When you support us, we will make sure that everybody knows about you and the good work that you're doing in the community. Speaking of community, as always, I feel like I need to apologize because this week got away from me and I didn't necessarily get a chance to do as much research as I wanted, but that's not going to stop us from trying to have an episode of real quality here with some important content. I hesitate to call anything I do here important except the work of trying to radicalize everybody I know towards the end goal of dismantling capitalism and liberating the human family. Stuff that I talk about quite a lot. So whenever I or anyone talks about ways to emancipate humanity, we get hit with a lot of questions, a lot of good questions, you know, and typically they're good questions. They're good faith arguments that are posing the important questions that face us every single day of our lives. How would anarchism work? How would libertarian socialism work? How would an actual communism work? Because I've made the argument on this this show any number of times that the quote unquote communist societies in our modern era are not actually communist because, surprise, surprise, the workers don't own the means of production. But anyway, the question always persists, what would these things look like? How would these things work? How do you liberate people from capitalism and still get stuff done? How do you feed everyone? How do you clothe everyone? Well, we don't need to make stuff up. We've never had to make stuff up. There has always been a historical record of societies that began implementing self-government, and they were always crushed. They were always crushed by external forces in the name of imperialism, colonialism, and more often than not, capitalism. Every single one to our modern era was crushed militarily. Genocides have happened in the name of imperial colonialism and capitalism for as long as human record can actually remember. Well, somewhat recently, a new example of this kind of attack on what a true democracy is, on an actual functional democracy, a new attack has begun. In the news, people are finally taking notice of northern Syria. And why? Because the president said that they were going to withdraw U.S. forces from the region. Okay. So this is not something that's necessarily been on a lot of people's minds, and quite understandably, because we're all trying to deal with all the BS that we are currently dealing with in our lives. And that's totally understandable. However, now it's something that people really need to think about. What people may not know is the incredible functional experiment that has been taking place in northern Syria for a while now, since 2012, I think, potentially earlier. What has been created in that region of the world is nothing short of astounding. And really, anthropologically, sociologically, and historically, this should go down as one of the most important moments in not just the contemporary era, but all of political history, period. What has been born in that region completely from the ground up on a grassroots level is astounding. And I really wish more people knew about it. And that's what we're going to take the majority of this week's episode to talk about. Let's talk about community for a second. The community in which you live ought to be the most important region of your life. And, you know, simply by region, I mean your neighbors, the people with whom you share space, you know, the literal land, the resources, the buildings, the places right around you, within walking distance, within, you know, a safe, easy distance of a mobility device. That should be of tantamount importance to you. And yet, more often than not, it isn't. We have kind of been forced to collapse our understanding of the habitable world to our apartment or our house, if we're lucky to have a house. The place that we are lucky enough to live, if we are lucky enough to have permanent housing, and more people are not that lucky. So we're going to talk a lot about community in this episode as it pertains to affinity groups and as it pertains, more importantly, to an economy of solidarity, which I've spoken about in previous episodes, but will require a little bit of a longer examination to go into fully. But to talk about community, we need to go back. Let's go back to 2012 and the years preceding. To do so, we need to kind of embed ourselves right in the middle of the Syrian civil war. We need to visit northern Syria. So back in 2012, there was what was sometimes referred to as the Rojava conflict. And really what that was, and in the years leading up to the actual conflict, in which the area would receive its autonomy, there was a fascinating clandestine grassroots movement. It started from neighbor to neighbor in secret meetings, talking about how the instability created by the civil war may actually have created kind of the perfect environment for them to actually gain freedom. Freedom from all authoritarianism. Freedom from all totalitarianism. Freedom from patriarchy. Freedom from capitalism. This happened absolutely in the ground, on the ground, grassroots level organization. Again, from neighbor to neighbor in communities, and then from community to community until a groundswell occurred and they were able to go public and they were able to actually defend themselves militarily and they were able to gain their autonomy officially in 2012. So that area is officially known as the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, or sometimes it's referred to as the Democratic Confederation of Northern Syria. But the people who live there and work there and organize there and have been defending the region since 2012 call it Rojava. Let's see, some of the sub-regions in the areas, Afrin, which was recently annexed by Turkey, Jazira, Euphrates, Raqqa, and I'm so sorry that I'm mispronouncing these, Tabqa, Manbij, and Deir ez-Zor. And I, again, apologize for probably just mangling all of those pronunciations. Okay, there are so many fascinating and incredible things about Rojava. I want to preface all of this. This is all going to seem like a love letter to it. I recognize fully that it is not some utopia. I recognize that things are not perfect. But also, let's just examine some of the incredible things that the people in Rojava have faced and dealt with miraculously. Okay, so first and foremost, the area is incredibly diverse. And we're talking about the kind of diversity that almost nowhere else in the world has. So it's referred to as polyethnic, and I think that's a real understatement. So you've got primarily ethnic Kurds. You've got a large Arab population, large Assyrian populations, Syrians, obviously. You've got people from Turkmenistan living there. You've got people from Armenia living there. You've got all sorts of different religions. You've got all sorts of different cultural backgrounds all coming together in a part of the world that is absolutely rife with sectarian violence. And what they have managed to achieve is nothing short of miraculous. And to talk about what they have achieved, we need to talk about the system that they have adopted. And they've called it democratic confederalism. And everything that we talk about, every single gain and every amazing system that they have implemented, you need to remember they did under constant threat from Turkey and Syria. They constant bombardment. On all sides, they have managed to grow and they have managed to thrive, all in the face of ridiculous political violence from every end of the spectrum that you can imagine. And also bear in mind that they were able to single-handedly get rid of ISIS or the Islamic State in the area. And they did so completely on their own with no help from any outside powers. And they did so while forming a completely new system of society, again, from the ground up on a grassroots level. So, to democratic confederalism, I could do a lousy job of trying to paraphrase, and instead we're just going to read as much of their constitution as we possibly can in the span of time that we have available. Okay, here we go. Constitution of North and East Syria. Preamble. We, the people of the democratic autonomous regions of Afrin, Jazira, and Kobani, a confederation of Kurds, Arabs, Syriacs, Aramaeans, Turkmen, Armenians, and Chechens, freely and solemnly declare and establish this charter. In pursuit of freedom, justice, dignity, and democracy, and led by principles of equality and environmental sustainability, the charter proclaims a new social contract based upon mutual and peaceful coexistence and understanding between all strands of society. It protects fundamental human rights and liberties and reaffirms the people's right to self-determination. Under the Charter, we, the people of the autonomous regions, unite in the spirit of reconciliation, pluralism, and democratic participation, so that all may express themselves freely in public life. In building a society free from authoritarianism, militarism, centralism, and the intervention of religious authority in public affairs, the Charter recognizes Syria's territorial integrity and aspires to maintain domestic and international peace. In establishing this charter, we declare a political system and civil administration founded upon a social contract that reconciles the rich mosaic of Syria through a transitional phase from dictatorship, civil war, and destruction to a new democratic society where civic life and social justice are preserved. Okay, so looking at the remainder of the text, the preamble is probably all we're really going to be able to get into if we want to actually talk about the history behind democratic confederalism and how it's been implemented in Rojava. So it all began with Abdullah Öcalan. He was a radical and one of the founding members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. While he was imprisoned in Turkey, he read a lot of the works of American anarchist Murray Bookchin, who had developed a very libertarian socialist theory, what he called communalism, which in and of itself is essentially based on participatory democratic institutions on the communal level. And it's stuff that's been talked about in how an anarchist society may work for a really long time, except Bookchin's work really had a focus on ecology and sustainability. So Öcalan is in prison. He reads the work of Murray Bookchin along with Nietzsche and other theorists that I'm not necessarily more as familiar with as I ought to be. But he made kind of a mix of all of these different theories, and most importantly, figured out a way that it could function specifically in the context of Turkey and northern Syria. So democratic confederalism, in his own words, is a system of popularly elected administrative councils allowing local communities to exercise autonomous control over their assets while linking to other communities via a network of confederal councils. So what does it look like in practice? Okay, the vision of democratic confederalism as practiced in Rojava specifically has a few tenets that it espouses and that are absolutely at the core of its principles. This is the liberation and empowerment of women. This is sustainable practices in every regard. This is direct democratic participation by everybody in the community. And this is about no private ownership of essentially what is the shared spaces in the community. So Rojava is a combination of a number of what's called cantons, and then within those cantons, which are regions within it, are what are called the communes. And a commune is essentially just a manageable group of people of a size anywhere from 100 to 150 typically, who share a space and who share resources and infrastructure and should have a directly democratic say in the management and use of those spaces. So, also Rojava has specifically adopted various forms of self-defense in everything they do. And again, they've had to do this because they've been under siege for the entirety of their history. But also because of the focus on direct democracy, on every member of a commune having a direct voice in everything that gets done, how it gets done, why it gets done, including women, most importantly women, this has been a revolution of women, they've been able to completely dismantle and abolish the police. They've been able to dismantle and abolish prisons because of this focus on self-defense. So, for example, every single member of the society has self-defense training. They're given free, available self-defense training by people in their community. And if you don't have people in your community who can do the training, then you reach out with a delegate, not a representative. A delegate from your area goes out to another area and gets people who do have the training to come to your area and give it to you. And the training, the free trade of training, you know, the exchange of people who know this kind of stuff and will freely train everybody else in your commune doesn't end with self-defense. In fact, it goes all the way up to the healthcare system. Everybody in Rojava has training in basic first aid. Everybody has training in a lot of different forms of medical care, and they've managed to essentially communalize their entire healthcare system, largely reducing the need for, you know, really severe hospital visits. Okay, so I talked about how there is no such thing as private property in Rojava. What does that really mean? So democratic confederalism uses a system called ownership by use. So people who have usage rights to the buildings and the land and the infrastructure do not have the right to buy and sell it on the market or convert any of those things to private enterprises. Instead, everything in the local economy is in the shared control of the communal councils. And so it's not collectivized, nor is it privatized, but it is all held in common. So that way, all of your neighbors in your commune have as much a right to come to every meeting and put forward proposals for how to use XYZ land or XYZ building. And, you know, for example, if you're already using that building, and if people feel that the use that you are, you know, providing is good for the commune, if it's good for the neighborhood, then there will be no reason to reappropriate it to a different cause. But if, for example, it's not being used well, if, for example, someone is hoarding land or if they're hoarding resources, then it's just up to their neighbors to take a simple vote and decide together that there might be a better use for the space that you're taking up. But the good news is that's going to be very rare, because it is in everyone's best interest to use the shared resources that they all have in common to the benefit of everybody. Because another huge tenet of democratic confederalism as practiced in Rojava is specifically the minimization of conflict. And one of the ways that they've done that is, again, through self-defense councils and committees. So there's two standing militias in Rojava. One is the YPG, which is a mixed militia, but then there's the YPJ, which is an entirely woman militia. It is formed 100% of women. And that's one of the militias that has done the lion's share of the work in defeating ISIS, because ISIS, or the Islamic State, is terrified of these women, because apparently in their code, if you get killed by a woman, you don't get to go to heaven. So needless to say, they're absolutely petrified of being attacked by the YPJ. Let's talk more about how women specifically have been raised up to positions of power and autonomy in this system. So every single time there is a council of any sort, and any time that there are going to be delegates, or any time that there are going to be representatives from one, you know, committee to take the information to another committee, there's always two elected. One woman and one man. There's never a single person whose job it is to make a decision. It is always two people, and it is always a woman and a man. Another way that women have specifically been lifted up out of their typically diminutive stance in the region and culturally. So there's a group of committees. There's the self-defense committee, there's the health committee, there's the education committee. All of these are made up of delegates from every commune in the area, specific to the regions that are affected by any kind of policy that's going to be adopted with regards to self-defense, with regards to healthcare, with regards to education, etc. And there is, most importantly, the Women's Assembly. The Women's Assembly has veto power on any legislation or policy that may be brought forward by any of the communes or any of the cantons, just straight up. So anything that appears to in any way support patriarchy or any way that may diminish the voices and powers of women in the region can be vetoed, no questions asked, by the Women's Assembly. While we're on the topic of the Self-Defense Committee, we can talk more about how this society managed to do away with and abolish the police entirely. So the Self-Defense Committee essentially trains people in their own self-defense, but then there are also community defense groups, which are always rotated. So for example, any position of quote-unquote power that a person can be put into, be it a delegate, be it a member of a committee, be it a board member of an assembly, be it someone in the community defense group, are always rotated. You cannot be in those positions for very long before you need to stand down and someone else comes in to take your place. So for example, the community defense areas or the community defense group's whole job is basically just to watch out for people, help people, support one another, provide mutual aid, and if necessary, then they have powers gifted to them by the commune in which they live and work. And that's the other thing. They live in the commune where they are, you know, where they're acting as community defense. And the only power that they have is specifically to mete out the required action as voted on democratically by the commune. So things, for example, like that can be ostracizing if somebody's done something wrong. It can be boycotting if somebody runs a business in the area. There's lots of different ways that someone can be, you know, met with. That's the other thing, is it's not punishment. It's their focus has always been on providing support for the person that was wronged and providing education, counseling, and further training and further socialization for the person who did the bad deed. There are no prisons in Rojava. That wouldn't be allowed, obviously, under the guidance of their charter. Unsurprisingly, violence among communes and specifically violence against women is nearly non-existent in the region. Okay, we don't have a lot of time left in this episode, so let's go over quickly what we talked about. We introduced people to the general idea of democratic confederalism as it's being practiced today in Rojava, northern Syria. Two-fifths of the country now has adopted this specific form of totally, directly democratic, grounds-up social organization. And now, thanks to the policies of President number 45, it is all directly under threat of violence from Erdogan and his Turkish fascist regime. So if there's anything you can do to lift the voices of those standing in defense of Rojava and democratic confederalism, now is such an important time to do so, because this shows unequivocally we do not need the current structures of power as they exist and as they have existed over the last few generations to run our lives. What we need is to get together with our neighbors and to begin talking about adopting these strategies and specifically changing them and shifting them to work within the model of our neighborhoods, because that's another important aspect of this. Democratic confederalism specifically talks about pluralism, tolerance for religion, tolerance for politics, tolerance for culture. And your culture is going to inform and educate the way in which you adopt direct democracy of this form. And whatever we do here in America in our communities is going to be different from what they're doing in Rojava. But I think it is crucial that we begin the work now. We build an economy of solidarity based on mutual aid, helping the people in our direct, immediate communities to work for each other instead of against each other. Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio. I've been NTSC, and I'll be back next week to talk about freedom. Peace.